And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when the evidence is getting to be overwhelming that the Republican Party is going to succeed, whether or not President Trump succeeds in getting himself elected. President Trump running ahead right now in most of the seven crucial swing states. But one of the things that is stunning is that on the Senate election, there is a major state which had not even been considered a vulnerable Republican state, where the Republican candidate for U.S. Senate is crushing the opposition in a landslide. And there's a new Washington Post University of Maryland poll about the state of Maryland, where Ben Cardin, who is the long-term Democratic incumbent, is retiring. And there's a battle between two major candidates for the Democratic nomination, Congressman David Trone and Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks. But both of them running against the Republican candidate for Senate, Larry Hogan, the former governor, lose badly. And just look at these numbers for a moment. If Hogan, who is a mainstream Republican, was a very successful, very popular governor, and a lot of people had thought that he might run for president or run on the no labels candidate ticket or something, but he didn't. And he has decided to run for the Senate seat, and wow. Okay, running against Representative Trone, he is up by 12 points. And this, again, in a very Democratic state, the Republican, Larry Hogan, leading by 49 to 37. And against Angela Alsobrooks, it's even more one-sided, 50% to 36%. That's remarkable. And what that indicates, remember, is with the Senate being so close, if that seat goes as overwhelmingly as it looks like it is going, then it's a settled matter. The Republicans will take control of the Senate, and it's probably going to be John Thune, who is the replacement, the senator from South Dakota, a good man. And that will probably be the replacement for Chuck Schumer as Senate Majority Leader. And by the way, more on the Senate races, because, okay, it's not just Maryland, it's Michigan. And Michigan, again, is supposed to be a safe Democratic seat. And Alyssa Slotkin, who is a congresswoman, a fairly popular Democrat in Michigan, this is taking over the Senate seat held by Debbie Stabenow, the Democrat. And Mike Rogers, who is a former representative and a terrific candidate, is actually tied with Alyssa Slotkin for that Senate seat in Michigan. So when you have the other seats that the Republicans are heavily favored to win, the seat in West Virginia that Joe Manchin is giving up, where Jim Justice, the sitting governor, is far ahead and almost a sure thing to win. You have the race in Ohio, which is increasingly Republican, against Sherrod Brown, who's the incumbent there. You have Nevada, you have Montana, another Republican state, where they have Sheehy is a former Navy SEAL, is a terrific candidate. This is really one of those things where, regardless of how things turn out with President Trump, because one of the things that that these polls show is that Of course, Trump is not going to carry Maryland. But Michigan is the swingiest of swing states. And in the Emerson College poll, Trump is tied with Biden in the state of Michigan. It's actually Trump leads by a single point, 45% to 44%, with 11% undecided. What's fascinating is none of these polls tend to put Robert Kennedy into the position. But he was just caught in this very embarrassing matter where he had said in a taped interview that he didn't believe that vaccines of any kind really worked or reliable or safe. And then he denied it. And it's just so striking because it's basically denying something that is undeniable because there it is on tape. Meanwhile, they're wrapping up, and I do think they're wrapping it up, the impeachment proceedings or the committee hearings that they were doing yesterday. Yesterday, the star witness was Bob Bielinski, who was the former business partner of Hunter Biden, and he got into something of a shouting match with Representative Dan Goldman of New York, a Democrat, who and accused Goldman of trying to cover for the Biden family. And this is what it sounded like. Listen, clip three.
10% held by H for the big guy, question mark. You remember that, right?
The infamous email with the big guy? Yes,
yeah.
I do.
Did anyone ever respond to that email?
Yes, they did numerous times.
Sorry.
Hunter Biden himself
excuse me,
did.
Excuse me. You're right.
Well, no, I think that's important because
sir,
Hunter Biden has claimed that he didn't respond to it, and he responded
okay.
to it.
You're just going to filibuster. I reclaim my time that's running out, but I will say no one responded to the big guy reference for 10.
Thank you for making my point. They didn't have to respond
right.
because
then,
they all knew the big guy was Joe Biden.
I reclaim my time. Mr. Chairman, please control the witness. I would like to say, I would like to get a little extra time, Mr. Chairman, because I want to read what Mr. Gilliar said to the Wall Street Journal. Quote, I would like to clear up any speculation that former vice president was involved with the 2017 discussions about our potential business structure. I am unaware of any involvement at any time of the former vice president. The activity in question never delivered and project revenue. 9 days later, the agreement without Joe Biden was signed. You and James Gilliar wanted Joe Biden involved, and that is why Hunter Biden dumped you and did the business on his own.
That's a blatant lie, Mr. Goldman. You
back.
Know better.
Chairman's time's expired.
Okay. Not so conclusive. There's more on this. And one of the Democrats in the committee, actually most of the Democrats in the committee, are trying to emphasize the obvious point that there will be no impeachment of Joe Biden. And that doesn't mean that he's a good president. It doesn't mean that he deserves all credit. It means that the lack of evidence of bribery, treason, or high crimes and misdemeanors, which you're required to get for an impeachment to remove the president from office, that's just not going to happen. And by the way, there's a piece today about the Democrats not expecting that the cavalry is going to arrive to rescue them from Donald Trump, that somehow there will be an additional court hearing or a conviction or some kind of financial problems. Trump has plenty of them right now. That's going to wipe him out as a candidate. That's very, very unlikely to happen. What is likely to happen on the Medved Show is that we welcome Dan Senor. He is the author of a book, The Genius of Israel, The Surprising Resilience of a Divided Nation in a Turbulent World. How is it Israel, with all of that, gets to be... We'll be right back. couple of years ago, there was a surprise bestseller that was a number one bestseller for quite a while, actually. And it was a book by Dan Senor and Saul Singer called Startup Nation, which was basically about the economic marvel of this small country. And it's small in geographical areas. It's a population of about 10 million people. It was a country called Israel that had become a real power in terms of its economic breakthroughs and its high-tech industry. And basically, the startup nation was obviously meant to call attention to the fact that Israel was started up as an independent nation really only in 1948, 75 years ago, and that it was now become a startup nation in terms of business startups and high-tech startups. There is now Dan Senor and Saul Singer again have collaborated on a new book, which is called The Genius of Israel, The Surprising Resilience of a Divided Nation in a Turbulent World, which came out before the horror of October 7th and the war in Gaza and all of the controversy. And in the midst of all that, and it's a welcome. I'm honored to welcome Dan Senor back to the show. Dan, you followed the story yesterday, which is just amazing, about the overall happiness rating. And did that come as a surprise to you that the only non-Scandinavian country rated in the top 10 of the world's nations? Well, of course, Netherlands is not technically Scandinavian, but it's right there. Israel's rated fifth, right after Finland, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden. Did that surprise you?
No. And I know it may be surprising. First of all, Mike, great to be with you. I actually just landed this morning from Tel Aviv, back in New York, and I was in Israel when the news of the new UN happiness report came out, which, as you said, they were number five, and they were, as you said, the only non-Scandinavian country, non-European country at the top of the list. The way the UN does this report is it's a three-year rolling average. So they look at ratings over 3 years. So one of those 3 years was 2023. Now, you could argue 2023 was possibly one of the most divisive and shattering years in Israeli history. Most of 2023 was consumed with the judicial reform debate in Israel, which, as you know, was deeply divisive inside Israel. Regardless of what one thinks of the agenda, it really tore up Israeli society. And then obviously October 7th, which was the single worst day in terms of the slaughtering of Jews since the Holocaust, all of that in 2023. And yet still Israel ranks number five when 2023 is included in the survey as one of the happiest countries in the world. And I think we tend to misunderstand what most people think of when they think of a happy life. They don't think of like a walking around with a smiley face and everything's going great and it's like Disney World. What the UN report measures is whether or not people feel that they're living a satisfactory life. They're satisfied, not like that they feel that it's they're leading a life of meaning, of purpose, of direction. And I think on that score, Israel and Israelis are excelling. Every Israeli I know, when you've seen what I'm describing right now flourish, even out of the ashes of the horrors of October 7th, which is the country comes together, they know they've got a thousands of year history, a multi-thousands of years that they are invested in, that every Israeli feels that they have ownership of. God willing, they believe they have thousands of years ahead of them of history that they've got, that they're custodians of. every Israeli, regardless of their political differences, some are more right-wing, some are more left-wing, some are more religious, some are more secular. It doesn't matter where they are in the country. They all feel a participant role in the society. They feel ownership of the society. They feel that every citizen is like a brother or sister. There's a real communal mindset in a healthy way, not at the expense of individualism, but there is a sense that they're part of something larger than just themselves and their own individual accomplishments. And so that gives them a sense of meaning, and that gives them a sense of purpose. And I think that it leads them to lead very satisfied lives, and therefore they factor very high in the happiness rankings, even when they have a horrendous year, even when things go terribly. They know that the lives they are leading in Israel matter.
Well, this goes directly to the most surprising detail in this ranking, which they break down the ranking into an overall number, and then for people who are 30 years old and under. And the United States does terribly with people 30 years old or under. We are ranked 62nd in the United States. Germany is ranked 47th. Canada is ranked 58th. Israel's ranked second. Mm-hmm. The only country in the world, according to these numbers in this study, where young people are happier than they are in Israel, is Lithuania.
Yeah.
But Israel's second to Lithuania. Okay. Does part of this relate to the fact that young Israelis are required to do service to the country?
Absolutely. So I want to put a little sharper edge on what you just said. When we wrote our book, The Genius of Israel, we looked at the loneliness crisis in the United States and the West. We looked at the teen mental health crisis, the teen suicide crisis. I'd never thought I'd say those words, teen suicide crisis, but it's a real thing. The CDC came out with a report when we were working on our book last March that said that the U.S. was experiencing a staggering epidemic, staggering rates of teen suicide or attempted suicide. I'm a parent of two teenage boys. Even saying those words, a teen suicide epidemic, is like chilling. I can go on and on and on about how troubled our young people are. And there's this weird dynamic, Michael, where all these countries are awash in resources, right? All these countries have become incredibly affluent. And yet at the same time, there's been this increase in affluence. I'm not saying it's correlation, but it's just a fact. I'm not saying it's cause and effect, but they definitely are correlated, where these countries are flourishing in kind of an immaterial sense. And yet young people are very unhappy, except for Israel. Israel, too, is flourishing in an economic sense. Basically, its GDP is basically, per capita GDP is basically doubled during the tech boom.
Dan, so can you hang on? Yeah. Let us continue the conversation. We're speaking with Dan Senor. His most recent best-selling book, The Genius of Israel. We will be right back about the ideas and practices and policies behind that genius. Very honored to welcome back to the show Dan Senor, who is the co-author of the new bestseller, The Genius of Israel, The Surprising Resilience of a Divided Nation in a Turbulent World. And resilience really is the key word here. The book was written entirely before October 7th. I'm right about that, Dan, right? And you had no idea that was coming.
No idea. It was a book that, as you said, Michael, was a book about resilience, how you build a resilient, upbeat, positive mindset in a society, in a population, where that comes from. And we wrote it in part as a playbook for Western countries like the United States that we feel, as you and I were just talking about, young people especially feel don't feel very resilient. They feel very isolated. They're leading these atomized lives. They're lonely. Many of them are depressed. Deaths of despair are high from drug abuse, alcohol abuse, suicide. And so we were writing a book, which was like a playbook, to look at a case study of a country that's flourishing on all these social metrics, and that contributes to the resilience of the society. We didn't anticipate that the resilience of the society would be tested like it was after October 7th.
And in terms of the resilience that's built in, we were talking during the break about the idea of the importance of feeling needed, feeling necessary, that your life has meaning in a larger scheme. And part of the universal service, which is a fundamental situation in Israeli life, everybody goes into either the army or into other forms of national service. And what's fascinating is I've heard that since October 7th, even some of the groups that have been exempted from military service, like the Haredim, the what is called ultra-Orthodox.
Ultra-Orthodox, yeah.
And some Palestinian Israelis have actually come forward and volunteering to serve. That's part of the national ethos, isn't it?
Yeah, so as you and I were talking about, in my book, we quote Sebastian Younger, who's a U.S. war correspondent who's followed, you know, the morale of and the unit dynamics of American military in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And he has this amazing quote about the U.S. where he says, and I'm quoting here, "Humans don't mind hardship. In fact, they thrive on it, on hardship. What they mind is not feeling necessary. Modern society has perfected the art of making people not feel necessary." Now, we quote from that in our book because Israel's the opposite. Everybody feels necessary, especially young people, as you said. The overwhelming majority of Israelis in their formative years, 18, 19, 20, 21, if not older, if they stay on longer, serve in the military. They do national service. Not only does it develop great leadership skills for them, it's like a crucible leadership experience, but they learn how to rely on one another. They learn how to not look at one another as the other, because when you're in the hull of a tank with someone who has religious differences or political differences or socioeconomic differences, it doesn't matter. You're together. And it reminds them that they're part of something larger than themselves, which is defending the country. And the fact that you have so many Israelis participating in that makes young people feel very engaged, to the corollary to what Sebastian Younger's talking about here. They feel necessary. And as you're saying, it's been so electric, that sense of wanting to participate in society, that even those who are exempted from military service, like the Haredim, they more and more of them, more than ever before, have been saying, no, I know we're exempted, but I want to serve. And you have Israeli Arabs who are volunteering to participate in some way. Now, the baseline is low, meaning they haven't been serving, so any uptick is a big percentage increase. So I don't want to overstate it, but the IDF officials who run the enlistment centers say they've never seen anything like this before, where people are showing up who don't have to. Reservists, when you're over 40 years old in the IDF, you age out of the reserves. And after October 7th, people who had aged out of the reserves were still showing up saying, I know I'm aged out. I don't have to be here. I know you probably don't want me, but I want to serve. So that means the reserve turnout, the IDF didn't know what the turnout would be, was something like 140, depending on the unit, 120, 150%, meaning way more people were turning out than they had called up. So that tells you something about the ethos of the country. It is a country where people feel that service is central and they want to participate. And again, even though service is hard, it's often sometimes tragic. It ends tragically. And yet it gives people a sense of purpose and meaning. And that, I think, cuts to why among young people, Israelis, according to this report, are so happy.
And there's another factor here, which is here in the United States, we have very, very bitter, angry political differences, as you understand. And people are talking all the time about civil war, we're going to secede, we're going to break apart. In Israel, there have also been, I mean, obviously very, very intense political differences, mass demonstrations, but no real talk about a civil war. What's another reason why not, other than the universal service in the army?
Yeah. So first of all, we say you're right that Israel's politically divided in normal times, and that's okay. Most of the Western world is politically polarized and has dysfunctional politics. What we argue in our book is that Israel has societal shock absorbers, that it doesn't allow political differences to actually rip the country apart. There's like these societal guardrails in place, and it is national service. I also think it's the power of national ritual. So we have a chapter in our book called Thanksgiving Every Week, which we say Israel every Friday night has the equivalent of a Thanksgiving. So I say to Americans all the time, tell me a ritual that you participate in with some regularity that's sacrosanct, that it's you, your family, your loved ones, maybe members of your community, and that when you're doing it, you know the whole country's doing it too. And they always give me one example, which is Thanksgiving. And I say, okay, so imagine everything you just described, but in Israel, they do it every Friday night. Now, some people do it differently. The more religious Jews, as you know, will do a very traditional Sabbath dinner, Friday night dinner. The more secular Jews will do it without perhaps all the blessings and for dinner. But the point is, there's a sense, and you know, having spent a lot of time in Israel and you have family there, there's a sense that the country slows down on Friday night. And if you look at the survey data, which we cite in our book, overwhelming majority of Israelis participate in a Friday night dinner with loved ones. Sometimes two, three, even four generations get together every Friday night. And what we argue in the book is communities don't create rituals. Rituals create community. And Israel is a country of rituals, whether it's the Friday night dinner that the whole country or most of the country participates in, whether it's Israeli Memorial Day, Yom HaZikaron, where the whole country stops while a siren goes off across the country and everyone gets out of their cars, their classrooms, their restaurants, their whatever, their office buildings, and they stand together for that two-minute siren and they think of loved ones that have been lost in service of the country, as well as the whole country. They're thinking about the collective too, people they may not know personally that they're honoring. And then Memorial Day goes right into the next day is Independence Day. So the message is we have our independence and freedom because of those who sacrificed for this country, that who we just honored the day before. And the Memorial Day and the Independence Day are linked. And I can go on and on and on with these rituals throughout the year, throughout the calendar in Israel, the religious calendar and the civil calendar or the civic calendar, that the whole country participates in. And it binds, it gives people a sense that they're binded to a nation, to a national project, and to their fellow citizens.
And this is all laid out with such passion, and it's a deeply moving book in addition to being informative and insightful. The Genius of Israel is the title. It's posted up at our website, michaelmedved.com. The Genius of Israel by Dan Senor and Sol Singer, subtitled The Surprising Resilience of a Divided Nation in a Turbulent World. And this is certainly a book for a divided nation in a turbulent world. Dan, great to be speaking with you, and we look forward to having you back soon.
The Michael Medved Show, all across America.
It's an honor to talk to you because I think you got the best talk show in the United States.
Thank you. I agree.
This
And on the Michael Medved Show, the United States of America has been falling in ranking of world happiness. And boy, you look at the graph and where we used to be and where we are now in terms of the happiness rankings, which, again, it's not everything, but it's kind of an indication. And part of it, and all of the articles written about this study, and where you can look at the top 25 by overall happiness, and people 30 and under in the United States, we are 62nd in the world. The United Arab Emirates are 35th. Young people are much happier in United Arab Emirates. Lithuania is number one. Israel is number two. Okay. With all of that going on, part of the problem, and it's specified in the articles in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and elsewhere, that part of the problem is the sense of political dysfunction in the United States. And the sense of political dysfunction. Well, there's good news for a long-term difference and good news on the short term. The good news on the short term is that congressional leaders just unveiled their $1.2 trillion, 1,012-page government funding package. That was released the early hours this morning. They are now racing to try to pass the six-bill measure, which covers the Departments of Homeland Security, Defense, Labor, Health and Human Services, Education, and State, the IRS, and the General Government and Foreign Operations. They're trying to keep these efforts operating. Do you think that the Defense Department is important? I mean, I kind of do. I mean, isn't it obvious that the Department of Education, well, again, it couldn't be a federal department, but it's still important when you talk about the level at which the entire school system in the country now depends upon that Department of Education. The IRS, if you're waiting for a refund, yes, that's important. And all of this, this is a shutdown deadline for all of these departments Friday night. It's midnight Friday night. So let us hope that they can make this work. Many rank-and-file lawmakers got their first look at the legislative text this morning, but both sides are already claiming wins. Okay, a win is to just keep operating, for goodness sake. And I mentioned that there was also some good news in the long term. There's a story on Bloomberg that a major GOP caucus, a Republican caucus, pitched Social Security reform, including an age increase before you get your Social Security. Now, the increase in age would not be applicable to people who are close to retirement age now. It would be applicable to the younger generation, and recognizing that there is a very, very different life expectancy than when Social Security was initiated. When Social Security was initiated, they had the same 65-year retirement, and that was at a time when life expectancy was 67 or 68 years. So it's a completely different situation. That budget plan calls for $16.6 trillion in overall spending cuts. That's from the largest caucus of House Republicans, calling for an increase in the Social Security retirement age, setting up a clash with President Joe Biden over spending on popular entitlement programs. Okay, what's remarkable about this, obviously politically this is not going to help, but it's going to help the country long term, because this Social Security, which people depend on, so many tens of millions of Americans, is simply unsustainable. And working on a gradual, meaningful change like this, the Republican Study Committee, which comprises about 80% of House Republicans, called for the eligibility age to be tied to life expectancy in its fiscal 2025 budget proposal. It also suggests reducing benefits for very top earners who aren't near retirement, including a phase-out of auxiliary benefits for the highest earners. And what that would mean would be, if you are earning very well, you would make preparations for your own retirement rather than depending on the same level of Social Security benefits for the people who have done very well and succeeded. And speaking of succeeding, there is more, which involves I thought you had it here, Jeremy, about the Finland and the other countries that do very well in the happiness measure. Finland has won 7 years in a row, has been the number one happiest country on earth, and which is pretty remarkable. But they one of the things about Finland is that in addition to some of the other Scandinavian countries like Norway, Norway is rated number seven in the world. But there is a the Danish army, for instance, consists of 7,000 to 9,000 professional troops, excluding conscripts undergoing basic training, according to official figures. Compulsory military service applies to men over the age of 18. However, because there are enough volunteers, not all young men are conscripted. In Finland, which is also rated very high, Finnish citizens aged 18 to 16 are liable for military service, and women can apply for military service on a volunteer basis. Military service is mandatory in Norway. There's a message here. And these are countries where the national share of happiness and satisfaction puts us to shame. And speaking of putting us to shame, there is going on about Arizona. We were talking about Senate races, and one of the very few Senate races where the Democrats seem to be enjoying an encouraging news is in Arizona, where Representative Ruben Gallego, who is a member of Congress, holds a four-point lead over the Republican candidate Carrie Lake in the Arizona Senate race. That, according to a poll released yesterday at Emerson College polling for the Hill survey, found that 44% of Arizona registered voters chose Gallego, while 40% chose Carrie Lake in the race to replace retiring Senator Kyrsten Sinema. 16% said they were undecided. You know what could decide that race and decide it for Carrie Lake? Would be if she would stop pretending that she won the governor's race. Because, again, this is one of those things where unless you are already deeply committed, the notion of going back to harp on a prior election for Carrie Lake, it's the election of 2022. For Donald Trump, it's the election of 2020. Could some of this have to do with Trump's difficulty in finding someone to pay his bond and to get him out of financial trouble? We'll be talking about that with A.B. Stoddard of the Bulwark. What happens next with all of these other financial problems that President Trump seems to be facing? There is actual talk that he should consider bankruptcy, which might help him. Will he? We'll talk about that and more coming up in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.